Local Talk Wednesday on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in our seven-county listening area in central Iowa. I am your host for today, Susan Franzen, expecting to be here with Paul Wearson, but I woke up with a cold, so Paul is at home with his moral support. So, hi, Paul. And to all you listeners, you are my co-hosts. Thanks for joining us. Has the coronavirus interfered with our schedule today? Yes. We have two phone interviews, so we can talk safely as long as we like. Our first is with Charlie Kostelnik, a former member of the Boone County Board of Planning and Zoning, who will give us a somewhat different perspective on the Boone Wind Farm than the one we heard last week from Max Jabrixio, the public engagement manager for Apex Renewable Energy. You were able to listen to Max's interview last week, weren't you, Charlie?
Unfortunately, I wasn't able to hear all of it, but I did hear just a little bit of it. This has been a busy time at Iowa State with the coronavirus and plans for that, and so we're all sort of on very tight schedules right now because of some planning around that. But in any case, I've heard the arguments by people who advocate for wind before. So I'm assuming that probably what he said I have heard before in other forms.
Okay. Well, I heard there was a meeting about the wind farm last Tuesday evening, the same day that I interviewed Max. Were you there?
I was, yes.
And how was that meeting announced?
I found out about it because there was a public announcement or an advertisement in the Boone News Republican, and there was an article about this wind project, and on a separate page it was announced that there was going to be this meeting. I'm not a landowner who received a notification from the Apex, the company that's doing the project. But I knew about it because of this public announcement. Most of the people who attended the meeting, of course, were people who had received notifications that there were transmission lines planned for eastern Boone County, northeastern Boone County. And, of course, they attended because they wanted to know more about it and express opinions about it.
You were aware of the project back when you were on planning and zoning. Isn't that right, too?
I knew that there was a project that was being considered, and I didn't know anything about the specifics about it. I still don't know very much about it at all. At that time, and I'm guessing this is about a year and a half ago or thereabouts when I was still on the Planning and Zoning Commission, a representative from Apex came to the meeting and wanted approval for a meteorological tower in extreme north Boone County, because this project, as I understand it, also extends into, also would extend into Hamilton County. And so they wanted permission to put up a meteorological tower. And so that's the only interaction I had with Apex or any notification about the project at all, other than the article that appeared in the Boone News Republican just a few weeks ago.
Could you describe the meeting?
Well, there were a lot of questions. Somebody from the Iowa Utilities Commissioner, or I don't think I have that correct, but there's a board that oversees utilities across the state, and a representative was there, and he basically read a script about what people who had a stake in the transmission line could do to express their opinions about it. And there were forms there that were provided if somebody wanted to do it by hand and send it in with a paper copy, and obviously there are options online. And so most of the meeting was about what the procedures would be for expressing concerns about the transmission line plan. Apex did say a few things about it and answer a few questions. And then there were expressions of concern by people who were there about whether or not they really had a voice in this, whether or not the plan was flexible, the extent to which consideration had been given to their rights as landowners who would be close to the transmission line.
I believe that you said that the bigger concern was with the people who are actually farming the land, many of who were renting it. So they didn't get the big payments from Apex, is that right?
No, the renters don't participate in any of the financial benefits of wind turbines. And I don't know what the arrangement would be with people who own property where the transmission lines would are planned for. I assume that there would be some sort of payment, but I honestly don't know. I don't know that the landowners know either. And that's one of the problems, Susan, with the whole process as it unfolds. And I watched it unfold a few years ago with the Beaver Creek project that Mid-America did in northwest Boone County. And so I got to see firsthand how this plays out, and landowners who don't have any financial stake in the process are almost completely excluded from any understanding or information about the project itself. And so it was heartbreaking for me to watch that happen, because people came to an open meeting of the Planning and Zoning Commission when Mid-America applied for the permit to go forward with the project. And at that point, it was contracts had been signed. Placement of turbines was already established clearly on a map. I mean, the whole project was, you know, ready to be begun. And people who lived in the area had no opportunity, as far as I know, to express any of their concerns about it, nor were there other public meetings that I'm aware of. That apparently there was one in Ogden, but I didn't attend that and didn't know anything about it. But in any case, the problem with the process is that people who have a stake in it have almost no voice. The ordinances for most counties are so extraordinarily wide open that they allow power companies to do virtually anything that they want to do, to put up turbines without the consent or the input of people who will be affected most by them, who live nearby and who do not have any financial stake in it, as well as those who potentially could, who don't want them. I mean, there are many landowners who live on the land who don't want to have turbines and just will refuse to sign contracts to do them. Many of the people who do sign the contracts, upwards of 75% or higher, are absentee landowners, and so they don't have to live with the turbines or be in an area where they're going to have to hear the sound and deal with the infrasound, inaudible results of the turbines, the flickers, the lights at night. I mean, they're completely removed from that. So people who are most affected by the turbines, in my understanding of the process as it played out, and it was really heartbreaking, as I said, have almost nothing, no input whatsoever.
So,
and the only redress that they have, honestly, is to hire an attorney and to litigate.
So what do you see? Do you see problems ahead for the wind farm, where do you see this conflict leading?
Well, unfortunately, the ordinance in Boone County is still very wide open, and so I don't really see that. I hope that people will ask questions and express their opinions when there are meetings available to them very late in the process. But the ordinance in Boone County is still not tight enough to really give landowners in close to the turbines much agency in the process. When I was on the planning and zoning, we discussed this a lot after the Beaver Creek project got the green light. Because we wanted to enable people who are most directly affected by the turbines to have a bit bigger voice. And that is my main concern, is that people who are going to be affected by them have a very large stake in the outcome of these projects, have a larger voice. And so what we recommended as a Planning and Zoning Commission were several steps that we wanted the Board of Supervisors to take, including having open forums before the project, before any leases were signed or any agreements were made with landowners, that everybody within the area, I think we had up to 5 miles within the footprint of the turbines, have open meetings where there were grassroots opinions that could be expressed and information sharing about what the project was going to be, so that everybody at the very early stages of the project would really have a voice. So that was a major step that we wanted Boone County to take. They did not. They rejected that one. The second one was the setbacks. We wanted the setbacks to be increased for dwellings to 2,500 feet, which is about a half a mile, which still isn't very much. But at least it would give people who lived in the area and own land or oftentimes small acreages more voice and agency in the process. Ultimately, the Board of Supervisors did increase the setback somewhat to 1,300, and I think they're 1,350 feet now, which is still very small. It's only a quarter of a mile, and the turbines are, at least in that part of the county, are 493 feet tall. And so if you think about a Washington Monument size object sitting, you know, outside your front porch, that is a fairly significant part of your life. Washington Monument's 555, these are 493, and they are just monstrosities that people who live near them visually and audibly have to deal with. So what we recommended was a much greater setback of 2,500 feet from a house with the provision that's already built into our ordinance that the person who wanted to have the turbine could seek a waiver from their neighbor. And so that's a provision that's there, and we just wanted to have people who are going to be affected by it have some power to negotiate with the person who wanted to put the turbine on their property to have some settlement or whatever, however they wanted to proceed. So because there's a bigger setback, it doesn't mean that necessarily was going to be observed. It just gives the person who doesn't have the turbine in their property the opportunity to negotiate with their neighbor who wants the turbine to come up with some reasonable settlement that both of them can agree on. And so that sounded like a way that people who were not benefiting from financially from the turbine but who were suffering the consequences would at least have some voice in the process by having greater setbacks and then knowing that the landowner who is going to benefit financially from the turbine could negotiate with their neighbors to do that. We also recommended differences in the decommissioning process. One of the problems with turbines is that they are, like any technology, they are going to fail and they're all going to be obsolete. And at some point, these will be dinosaurs. And if you consider that they have a 40-year life, think about 1980 and the technology that was available in 1980 and how ridiculous it would be to think that these turbines still will be relevant in 40 years, let alone 30 or 20 or even 10. So they have to be dealt with at some point. They have to be taken down, and we had specific recommendations for decommissioning because the decommissioning plans or in the ordinance were way too lenient, and basically it gave the power companies free license to pretty much do whatever they wanted to do. We also had a recommendation for the height. We wanted to lower the height, and we also had a recommendation for noise. Neither of those went forward either, and they did not get adopted. So we came up with a plan that would enable people who have a stake in the turbines to have greater voice and to have greater protections with the ordinance in the county without disallowing the turbines by any means. I mean, these ordinances would not prevent by any means people putting up wind turbines. It just would empower people who are going to be affected by them to have more voice and to have more reasonable guidelines for what would be a livable environment once these went up.
Do you see this as being a major block toward having wind energy? Or do you think that it's something that can be worked out to everybody's satisfaction?
Well, our recommendations were not adopted by the Board of Supervisors in Boone County, with the exception of the increase in the setback from dwellings, which was only half of what we recommended. And then also they had changed the decommissioning plan slightly to make the wind company a little more responsible. So it depends on what you're referring to, our recommendations or the ones that are in place. The ones that are in place in Boone County, no, they will do nothing to slow down wind turbines or to empower people who live with them and have no financial benefit from them. They will not benefit virtually at all. So, no, it won't change anything, in my opinion. But there have been counties that have put moratoriums on wind power. that have had stiffer ordinances that gave local landowners more power. Madison County, there was a big debate there, and I believe there's a moratorium where they have more restrictive ordinances in place, or at least proposed. And so I think there are about 250 government agencies in the U.S. that have put greater restrictions on wind energy without shutting wind energy down at all, but just saying, you know, there has to be more responsibility to people who live in the area who are going to be affected by this.
Well, it sounds like a difficult situation going forward, but at least apparently everybody's talking to everybody.
Well, I wish everybody was talking to everybody. That is the problem, Susan, and that I recognize when we had our open meeting and I heard some people who were talking about this possible effect on them. I was all for it. When Mid-America came in and they said, you know, we're going to provide, you know, some revenue for the county, landowners are going to make some money on this, it might yield a few jobs, I was all for it. You know, it sounded to me like a great idea, but the more I heard people who were going to be affected by it, their stories, and I did interview people both in our county and elsewhere across Iowa, it was just really horrible what people were going through who had no voice in the process, who were completely shut out. Everything was done behind closed doors, neighbors signing contracts that their neighbors knew nothing about, and it was just horrible to watch what the devastating effects on people who lived in areas that were heavily populated by wind turbines. And so I just did more research and continued to study it, and the more I studied the wind turbine industry, the more flags kept popping up. And so I don't think the greater restrictions would, at least in our county, would by any means disallow wind energy, which I think a lot of people think is a good thing. I drive through Kansas occasionally, and I see these huge wind farms and industrial turbines out there, and, you know, there isn't a soul living within miles of them, I'm sure. There's a place for them where they would be quite benign, but when you have lots of people living in rural areas like counties like Story and Boone and around here close to the metro area, it's a different situation. And they're definitely affected by these, and they have, as I said earlier, no real voice in the process. So what our proposal would have done and was simply give more power to people who live in the area to have a voice in the process. And so if you say, okay, put the setbacks, whatever you want, make them a mile, half mile, whatever, it then creates a conversation between neighbors. And so, okay, you're my neighbor, and, you know, I know you have a right to put this turbine up, but I also have some rights, you know, for the sound and the visibility of these things, and so let's talk about this and see if we can come up with an agreement. I think that's a reasonable way to go forward, and I don't think that would slow down the turbine industry. I think it would give people who have a stake in it some voice in it and make it more responsible to people who are going to be living with these. So that's my main concern, is that we have a system in place, a process in place, where people are not just surprised. They go to a meeting and now they find out that this whole plan has been done behind their backs and they have no voice in the process at that point. I mean, they can say what they want to say, but the ordinances are in place. There have almost no restrictions. You can do almost anything you want if you're wind turbines. And so at that point, you're pretty much left to your own ability to, as I said before, litigate or voice concerns to the Iowa Utilities Board. But at that point, it probably isn't going to do much good.
Well, thank you very much for bringing up these points that I think a lot of our listeners are concerned with.
And they should be, because they don't know what the consequences are going to be. I interviewed people who the noise was just intolerable. There was one person in Boone County who the infrasound disrupted sleep. There are health consequences for some people. It's not everybody. It's not uniform. But there are consequences to the wind turbines in terms of your daily life and the quality of life, as one of my fellow members of the commission put it, that it just is a quality of life factor. And people don't realize when they look at them from the road and they see them 2 miles away, they don't realize that they do make noise. There are infrasound that come off of them. They're flickers. They're the night lights. I mean, these are pretty invasive, disruptive objects that they're going to have to deal with if they have them somewhere reasonably close by to where they live. So I think it's the unknowns that people should be aware of, that they should do their homework and find out what they can so that they have a voice and also have an informed voice.
Well, thank you so very much. That was Charlie Kostelnik. Thanks for being with us
today. Thank you for
talking
to me. Listening to Local Talk, and I'm your host, Susan Franzen. We've been visiting with Charlie Kostelnik, who gave us a follow-up on last week's story about the project in Boone, Iowa, by Apex Renewable Energy. And now I have the answer to your second question, or to Paul's second question, if you'd been here, about the coronavirus. We were planning to inform our listeners about a lavish feast prepared by the Iranian students for the celebration of the spring equinox, or Nowruz, the Iranian New Year. And it was planned for this week because we wanted people to have plenty of time to get reservations in for the feast. Well, it's been canceled, which probably won't surprise people who've been following the news about the coronavirus. But I felt that it was important to play the interview anyway, the interview that I had, including some of the traditional music. It will be a bleak new year for the Iranian students here, not only because they can't gather for their festival, but the news from Iran is alarming. I will read a paragraph from an article I saw online from Politico. It was yesterday's article. You can imagine the concern Iranian students here are feeling for their families. Here's a quote from the article. Iran is the main center of contamination and exporter of the coronavirus outside China. But ongoing U.S. sanctions have made matters worse by making the Iranian regime more skittish about taking any public health measures, such as reducing contacts with its main trading partners or declaring a public health emergency that could further damage its already ailing economy.
History shows that continuing Iran's isolation as it grapples with coronavirus risks backfiring on the United States and the rest of the world. So it's a pretty serious situation. And the reason that I want to play this interview is that when I told my Iranian friends that we were going to go ahead and tell our listeners about the traditions of Nowruz, the Persian or Iranian New Year, along with a history of the ancient festival, they were pleased that we would have a few minutes of the celebration that they hold so dear, and a few minutes without anyone needing to worry about the virus contacting them. You may recognize Fran Amin from our story a couple of weeks ago about the ISU graduate student who was denied entry to the U.S. It's a hard time to be Iranian, but that is all the more reason to remember the cultural traditions that they celebrate. It's been going on for 3,000 years, and that is something to celebrate. So let's listen to the holiday of Nowruz.
I am with Fran Amin and Nasim Sabitpour, who are here to tell us about the Persian New Year. And I'll let them introduce themselves.
Okay, my name is Nasim. I'm here, PhD student in computer science, and I'm doing research on database, which is my main field of interest here at Iowa State University.
You were a PhD student. Did you do your undergraduate work here in the U.S. or in Iran? And where?
In University, Islamic Azad University of Tehran, science and research branch.
Tehran home for you?
Yes.
And Fran Amin has lived here. But why don't you tell us a little about yourself also, because you are
a native in Iowa.
How long does it take to become a native in Iowa?
Oh, you don't want to know.
Did you come here as a student?
Yes, I did. I came here as a student, as a graduate student. I had already had my degree in physics from University of Tehran. And I came here and got my master's in biomedical engineering at Iowa State University and stayed. And I have worked many years, Iowa State actually, and also for a private industry. And the last part of my tenure was with the state of Iowa. And I'm retired now. So that tells you how long I've been here.
When is the Persian New Year? What is the date of that?
The moment the sun crosses the equator and equalizes night and day is calculated exactly, and that is the reason we don't have a specific time each year to celebrate, and it's going to be different from year to year. But the fixed thing is that it's in the beginning of the spring.
You need to know a little bit of astronomy to figure this out.
Well, I guess that the Persians were very good astronomers.
They were, actually. Yeah, that's true.
What's the relationship between Persia and Iran?
In the Western world, Persia has historically been the common name for Iran. Persia is basically a Latin derivation of Iran. In 1935, Reza Shah, the first king of Pahlavi dynasty, asked for indelegates to use the term Iran, the historical name of the country for the people at that time. Native people used this term in formal correspondence. Since then, in the Western world, the use of word Iran has become more common and popular, and also changed the use of the name of Iranian nationality.
Iran actually has always been called Iran. But Westerners decided to call it Persia.
So that's why you have Persian carpets.
Persians, yeah, exactly. But Iran is always, I mean, from ancient times, you know, the Iran plateau has always been called Iran.
So why do you call it the Persian New Year instead of the Iranian New Year?
Well, we do. We kind of interchangeably, you know, use both terms because an American or a European or whatever, if they don't understand Iranian, when you say Persian, they understand better. But for us, it's Iranian New Year, basically.
Why don't we start using it, the name that you call it by? What is the name?
Nowruz.
Nowruz.
Yes, which means new day.
How old is this holiday?
goes back to over 3,000 years ago. In Persian mythology, you know, this king, King Jamshid, saved his people after a very, very treacherous and hard winter. And people, you know, were so happy, and they all decided that that day when winter had passed and, you know, the spring actually had arrived, you know, they decided that they're going to celebrate that day, and that would be a new day, basically. So goes back many, many thousands of years. So,
yeah. And is this today associated with any particular religion?
No. Nowadays, it's secular tradition. Yes, we all from different background and ethic, we celebrate this day.
It's an Iranian celebration and holiday. It has nothing to do with any religion, at least now. You know, back then it started with Zoroastrian.
And do you still have Zoroastrians? Or I think we pronounce it differently, Zoroastrians.
Zoroastrians, yes.
Just, I'm only saying that because our listeners might not understand the word, even though it's the very same word.
Yes, we have Zoroastrian nowadays in Iran, in southern part of Iran. We have,
But the majority of them, I think it's in, you know, they're in India. A lot of Zoroastrians, did I pronounce it okay? A lot of them are in India. And there is a population, I have no idea how many of them are still in Iran.
I understand you have Iranian students and scholars?
Yes, here Iranian Students and Scholars Association, it's supposed to be like home for Iranian students here. We have three main festivals, which this one is the biggest one among all.
برین بوی نارنج و ترنج و عطر بید میتوان از تربت حافظ شنید.
باز شد چشم بهاران بر خزر، شد صدف ها خانه در و توهر، دشت ارجن باز هم بید.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I, Susan Franzen, have been your host for today. And we have another event that is canceled, but as a result, we have a wonderful interview with the author who was to have spoken at the Cane Bridge Memorial Library this next week. This was an evening with John Domini, which is being postponed until fall. John is a truly distinguished author living in Central Iowa. He's written four novels and three books of short fiction, and has completed several translations. He's been the recipient of an NEA Fellowship and the Iowa Major Artist Award. He lives in Des Moines, Iowa, but his novels are set in Naples, Italy. Fortunately for him, he's in Iowa now. Welcome, John.
Very happy to talk. I do think that Cambridge Memorial Library, Jay Robinson there, is doing the prudent thing. I think this is wise to cancel for the upcoming reading. And he, he will reschedule for the fall.
Bortman, I'll be able to come down and record it for Heart of Iowa because I was really looking forward to hearing you. But the great thing about radio is that you can listen to whatever you want without any viruses. You might get them on your computer, but you won't get them through the radio waves.
I'm happy to get it either way, and I'm happy to fill folks in on what I've been doing.
Well, it's pretty overwhelming. I guess ostensibly you're talking about the color inside a melon.
It's the third of a series of three, yeah. I have four novels all together, and the last three have been the Naples novels.
Why did you choose Naples?
My father came from Naples, and I had visited. He grew to adulthood there. He experienced World War II there. It was a terrible thing, and he wanted to leave and was able to build a life in this country in the way one could in the 1950s. He started a business, and I did visit when younger, but the real immersion came for me at a difficult point in my personal life. A marriage had broken up. My professional, I had work, but my career was going nowhere. And as a way of remaking myself, Cheryl Strayed went out and hiked the Pacific Coast Trail, right? That's the story of Wild. I went back to Naples, lived with my family, lived on the cheap, and Naples inspired me to a series of novels.
Well, one of the things that struck me in just reading the plot outlines was that it was set after the next earthquake.
Yes, that's my imagining. Well, I can talk about the metaphor or the real thing. I'll talk about the real thing for a moment. Naples is historically on unstable tectonics. The ground underfoot is unstable. There's a volcano that's famous on one side. That's Vesuvius, buried Pompeii, for instance. And on the other side, there's actually another volcano, though lesser known. It's called the Burning Fields there, Campi Flegrei. So they do have earthquakes. They have small ones often, and the latest large one that caused a lot of homelessness and extensive problems was in 1980. So, yeah, it's a natural for the imagination, I would say. You imagine what will happen the next earthquake, big earthquake, hits Naples. Now, on the other hand, metaphorically, you could say the earthquake's going on around us all the time. And Naples is certainly a place that has seen tremendous changes, in particular with the arrival of so many people fleeing Africa and the Middle East. Immigrants are pouring into Europe, and it's changing the makeup of a town like Naples.
Well, how do they arrive? Do they arrive by boat? How do they get there?
Any way they can would be the answer. But yes, some are the classic boat people who illegally arrange transit across the Mediterranean. Some arrive, with visas and, in jet planes. But then they wind up staying. They keep finding some job or other, and they stay. Those were the two things I had in mind: a changing society on an unstable geology, and seemed pretty promising to me. I hope I brought it off. I hope it worked. I was also, of course, just working through, like any artist, I was working through my own personal crisis. Each one of the novels has a different protagonist, different main character, with a different point of view on the changes going on. One is an American woman visiting. One is a native-born Neapolitan. And one, and the last one, the latest one, is a Somali refugee. Each of them sees the city differently. And I, you know, to some extent, I too saw the city with new eyes when I came back in midlife.
Were you immersed in each of these different cultures? especially, how did you get immersed in the Somali culture?
Well, it's first off, you know, the only effective proof of whether I know that culture well is in the book. It's not in my life. You have to read the book and see if it comes off, my presentation of this man's experience. But, I did my research. And, of course, if you're living with family, if you're living on the cheap, I did pick up jobs. I made many friends. You know, you encounter Africans, and you discover, for instance, that Somalia and Libya were, I mean, maybe I knew this already, but Somalia and Libya were the Italian territories in Africa. And in fact, in Mogadishu, in Somalia, you know, when they eat pasta con vongole, spaghetti and clams. I didn't know that, but a lot of people in Somalia, at least of a certain generation, spoke Italian. And so, you know, you meet them. You just meet them in the street. They're working at bars. They're working in the same jobs that immigrants here have. And you also discover that they're making their way in the arts. The arts, in one form or another, is how a lot of marginal cultures get ahead. But I did other research. There's something in Naples called the Immigrant Council. It's in every big city in Italy. And I attended a meeting, and I talked to lawyers. And I visited a refugee camp, spoke with refugees. I read lots of books, you know. I did the usual research. And, you know, I tried to open up my heart and my mind to how things look to somebody from a very different place. The best measure of whether I managed it is in the book.
Well, do we have time for you to read just a little bit? Just about 10 minutes, if you could read.
Yeah, sure. I can read a bit, sure. All right, then we'll go there. And I'll just say to everybody, keep an eye out for what's coming in Cambridge Memorial Library. I was very much looking forward to the reading.
Well, we'll definitely be publicizing that in the fall when we have a date. So the people who hear this can be listening for the announcement. So, and in the meantime, maybe they can read a book or two.
All right, so I'm reading from The Color Inside of Ella. The protagonist, as you've heard, is a Somali refugee, and he's one of the lucky ones. He's made good. He runs an art gallery, and as I say, the arts is an area where immigrants and other outsiders have long been able to get ahead, also in this country. And I'm going to read from a short passage later on, a bit of a descriptive passage, in which his name is Risto. Risto is actually fleeing the city. He's been urged out of Naples by a homicide detective he's been working with. The book is in part a murder mystery. Now, Risto is leaving town, but one of the first things a reader notices is that he's not getting on a train heading south to where his wife is on vacation with the kids, his white Neapolitan wife, who has meant so much to his transition. He is on a ferry heading out to the island. So he's on the ferry, the upper deck, and Risto had a bench to himself. It was therapy, alone in a breeze full of salt and fermentation. For this trip, he preferred the slow boat, a fat old traghetto. The low-slung hydrofoils made for a shorter journey, but they didn't have the deck space. If you did find a seat outside, you risked getting your phone doused by spray. The gallery owner on the slow boat intended to use his phone. The calls, just a couple, shouldn't be too hard on him, but till now he put them off. They hadn't seemed reason enough to stop moving. He'd skip swinging by the apartment, too, driven to get some distance, some perspective. At his back, besides, he had the detective. This man, Della Figurazione, had some powerful dreams going about this case. And the last thing the officer wanted was some hyperactive Nero in the way. Nero, a black man. But then Risto himself was sick of his own hyperactivity. The getaway mattered more than grabbing a change of shirt. Topside on a ferry, for some reason, you caught the communications boomerang better than with a phone on the beach. Risto got a connection clear as a bell on his first call, the one out to the island. In no time, he confirmed that he was welcome and therefore in his right mind. His man on Capri remained the same as ever, sharing the house with a lady friend. He wasn't one of those who preferred to go unseen either, and for Risto, they would pull together a little party. At this, the man who'd just invited himself over had no choice but to sound pleased. Maybe he was, anyway. Maybe island-style debauchery, more understated than in the city, would be good for him. After all, the ride across the Gulf looked like 45 minutes of solo meditation. But before the second call, he tried to force down one of the shipboard panini. Bad idea. The sandwich might have dated back to the Crusaders. Marauding knights like those who'd put up the Castel del Ovo, the hulking waterfront keep. You got a great view as the ferry pulled away. And come to think, that castle on the waterfront had a lot in common with Risto's attempt at lunch. It had a color you might call desiccated bread, if not ham past expiration. Worse, the humpbacked medieval warren, Castel del Ovo, was a drain on the city. Every administration tried out something new. Last year, an arts venue. This summer, a prison. It had been the only place the police could find for locking away some immigrant protester. Anyway, somewhere amid the castle's decaying brick, undoubtedly there lay the fossilized remains of the other panini put together the same day as this one. Per carità, the Crusaders had no idea about food to begin with. What did they eat, those blonde demons? Bones and mead? They'd be boat people anyway, pirates. Yet they'd had the nerve to claim Naples as northern and white. And I'll leave it there for now, just a short taste. First, thank you for letting me read, and I hope it was interesting and entertaining.
Oh, yeah. I think people will want to read the book and find out what's going to happen at that party and so forth. Yeah.
Thank you. The party is interesting, but you'll notice Risto keeps putting off one call.
Yeah.
He's not calling who? He's not calling his wife down the coast. He's just not up to it yet.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is another thing in the book. They're not facing divorce exactly, but what he's doing is at least troubling to his marriage. And it's something he has to over, it's a hurdle he has to overcome. Okay, the color inside a melon. Well, his wife is white. He is black. And she is Neapolitan. And there is, in fact, an old Neapolitan saying about the color inside a melon that refers to race and goes back to the ancient southern Italian connection to Africa. It's, you know, it's in the Moors, the Muslims out of North Africa took over Sicily and a good deal of southern Italy. And, of course, there's a lot of African blood in southern Italy. And the color inside a melon is an old parable in Naples that says if the color inside a melon turns out good, if it isn't rotten, then what is there to fight about? And in other words, it's another of these sayings. We have some, too, in English, that says it doesn't matter what color you are on the outside. But that expression, we learn the parable early in the novel. The wife tells it. It's an interesting story. And then that expression gets examined and turned around a number of different ways.
Okay. Well, this is something to keep us going until fall, I guess. Do you recommend that we start with your first novel?
I wonder if any author would recommend anything except their latest book, right? Aren't you always fondest of the thing you finished later? It's hard for me to recommend anything other than my current novel, The Color Inside a Melon. But, you know, this is America. You're free to read what you want.
Well,
but, yeah, I'd love it if they started with color. Yeah.
Okay.
But I have other books. I have books of stories,
yep.
Books of essays,
yep.
All sorts of other things.
Okay.
In fact, I can announce here that I've just sold a memoir.
Well, wonderful. Unfortunately, we can't hear any more about that because we have the end of the hour coming up on us. So it's been wonderful talking with you, John. That's John Domini. And thank you so very much. This is KHOI. You've been listening to Local Talk, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I've been your host for today, Susan Franzen. Other voices you heard were Charlie Kostelnik, Nassim Sabatpour, Fran Amin, and John Domini. Local Talk will be rebroadcast at noon and 7 p.m. You can listen to today's Local Talk show and any of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. Local Talk was engineered by Paul Hertz. Our theme song is Backtracking by Al Harrison. Tom Richards, other music you heard was Windy from the CD Essentials by The Association and traditional Nowruz music provided by the Iranian Students and Scholars Association. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI meaningful and possible.
Support for KHOI is provided in part by Stevens Auditorium, presenting Waitress, Thursday, March 12th at 7 p.m. Tickets and more information at center.iastate.edu.